coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville. It's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville Resistance Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we're speaking with Camilla Fojas, author and professor of media studies, whose research and books are just a fascinating look at how through popular culture, Americans see themselves and those perceived as the other, exploring American imperialism, capitalism, nationalism, race and ethnicity, as well as justice and tolerance. She's explored all kinds of media, television, books, film, advertisements, and journalism, with descriptive titles in her books such as Zombies, Migrants, and Queers, Border Bandit, Hollywood on the Southern Frontier, Islands of Empire, Pop Culture and U.S. Power, and Mixed Race Hollywood. She's working on a new book on migrants at the border and the security apparatus there, Border Securities, Border Futures. We'll talk all about that. And we have Ashley Walding, the Director of Outpatient Behavioral Services at the Virginia Institute of Autism, a Charlottesville organization which helps children and adults overcome the challenges of autism and participate more meaningfully in the daily life and gain more independence. We'll talk about how they do that, and we'll hear some amazing stories. So in just a year and a half, we have spoken on this program to over 100 talented, scholarly, fascinating guests just like these about everything from the rise of fascism to the life of bees, from Black Twitter to the refugee crisis, from soul food to how to make a balanced cocktail, and so much more. Check out all our podcasts. You can download them at 947wpvc.org. And my friend, Nancy Lawrence, are you there on the line?
Ellen, I am here. And as ample as your introduction was, I think I need to add one more thing.
What's that?
You always guarantee that we're apropos of something.
Yes.
I think we should also guarantee that we're collusion-free.
We are totally collusion-free.
I think our listeners should know it's a collusion-free show.
And I don't know how I couldn't do this without you. I don't know how I could do it without you. I have not been tied to the news.
I don't know. I think it just a little duct tape and you'd be fine is really my answer to that. I am just a walking piece of duct tape.
I was visiting family up north, and I missed, maybe thankfully, a lot of the news. But as I eased into it, I heard this familiar refrain in many different forms. This has been an extraordinary 9 days of news. So this is my take on it. 12 Russians were indicted. Orange traitor aimlessly walked in front of the Queen of England. Putin and Orange traitor met for 2.5 hours over no one knows, but the interpreter might. And then he finally got the Time magazine cover, which is a morph, a creepy and chilling morph, which is Putin and him morphing his faces into each other. And I'm sure you can fill in the gaps.
Well, to that last Time cover, yeah, I have a name for that dual, double negative. Excuse me. I'm calling him Donimir Trumpkin.
Donimir Trumpkin. Trumpkin.
Exactly.
It Trumpkin. Just rolls off the tongue.
Yes. So anyway, I know it is outrageous, and the only highlight in that fiasco overseas, in my opinion, were all the amazing treasonous words that the UK came up with for the orange traitor. I mean, one of my favorites was the tangerine wank maggot. I thought that was an excellent one. There were such excellent ones, but anyway, I know it's outrageous. It is a very serious, unbelievably unbelievable.
Chilling.
Is really what it is. That I don't even know if we have enough prosecutors to handle what is going on.
What has anything developed with Mueller? I mean, he's got so many loose ends to tie up that, again, I think we've said this before, he's going to be so busy that nothing, I mean, the world will end before he gets done.
Yeah. I think just the idea that they were meeting for 2 hours, I'm pretty sure if Putin doesn't already have the launch codes, then when he arrives in November for the military parade, he's obviously getting an autographed copy of them. I mean, it's
yeah. You know what I was thinking?
There's nothing that guy won't do.
Like a Star Trek episode. Like one day we're just going to turn on all of our screens as we always do, and on every screen it's just going to be Putin's face telling us what we need to do. You know, it's just going to be... I am now controlling.
Well, that's why I'm not going to upgrade my computer. You just convinced me. No, he'll never get into my OS 9, I believe, whatever it is I'm working on.
Well, luckily,
he won't get me. I'm the one. I'm going to be the resistance. I can tell already.
Yeah. All the Luddites like you are going to be the ones that survive. So a really important event today I wanted to mention in Charlottesville is the Cured Bacon Festival. It is at the Pavilion. It's all about the smoked pork from 1 to 5, and local chefs are going to serve up a few of their own bacon themed dishes from restaurants like the Whiskey Jar, Parallel 38, Maya Feast, the Ivy Inn, and a lot more. There'll also be local brews flowing from Star Hill. You have to get tickets online.
Sounds cool. I love that. Yeah. You have a pavilion.
Oh yeah,
that sounds so two centuries ago.
Yeah.
Is it old, the pavilion?
No, it's just this canopied outdoor space where concerts happen.
And apparently booze will be flowing.
Yes, it will. And also tonight, I'm doing the light version of events. Usually, you know, we talk about all the important things, which maybe you can help with. But another light one is tonight at the Bridge, music from Windbreaker, Pistol, Voice of Saturn. It's supposedly a solid mix of dance floor ready sounds and moodier synth atmosphere. Hard kicking drums. Let's see.
There's never enough... Is that the right? Is there too many double negatives? We should always have time. I'll just make sure it's for dancing. So,
oh yeah,
very important, this event you mentioned.
And then one other thing that I think Seville said about Voice of Saturn is it's live homemade acid space noise. I don't know what that means. But I think it'll be mind-numbing, so I think that's what's in order. And Lampo Pizza are going to be serving up some burgers and fries.
Well, after the mind is denumbed, I'm going back to a reminder to our collusion-free listeners to call the Senate general number 202-224-3121. Call your representatives, your senators. Call random states, which is what I do. And there's just not enough. Just, of course, the Kavanaugh nomination still going on. And just that idea that a president under investigation should not be able to nominate anyone. If you don't like that one, then why didn't, you know, Congress subpoena the interpreter? What's going on with the families? Secure the election? Your choice. But just pick up the phone every so often and call a random state and their senators and congresspeople and, of course, your own.
You know, what you're saying reminds me of, like, how people are motivated to do things. So, like, American Idol or The Voice, people call in and vote.
Right.
There should be, like, a show that someone puts on that's much more widespread than this one on television where we're urging people to call senators all the time and just motivate them.
I think it could fly.
All right, enough of my foolish ideas. We have an amazing show.
Yes.
Oh, did
please.
You have something else you wanted to say?
Yeah. Nope.
I wanted to get right to the important part of our show. Our first guest is Camilla Fojas. She is an associate professor in the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. She's an author and professor of media studies, as I mentioned, whose research and books are really fascinating. They're a look at how, through popular culture, Americans see themselves and those perceived as the other, exploring American imperialism, capitalism, nationalism, race, and ethnicity, as well as justice and tolerance, and probably a lot more. She's explored all kinds of media to do so. Her books are Zombies, Migrants, and Queers, Border Bandit, Islands of Empire, and again, many more. So, Camilla, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I'm never not happy to be here.
That's great. That is great. I like that. So you cover so much ground in your work. I mean, I barely scratched the surface. Let's talk about something that seems important right now, which is the border. So what's the connection with your work let's see, what is it called? Border Bandits, Border Hollywood Bandits. On the Southern Frontier. What's the connection between Hollywood and the border? And what led you to write that book? Because you probably didn't write it yesterday.
I mean, I did. It's been a few years, but part of what I was looking at is the really long history that Hollywood has on the Southern Frontier, on the border. And a lot of these films are Westerns, and we don't think of them as border films, but they take place on the border, and they use a lot of the kind of tropes that we see in even border media today, good guys, bad guys, the kind of ideas about nationalism and about the United States that I think continually return to films. So the Western is one of the most enduring genres. And so that was one of the reasons why I wanted to look at border films, not just border films that are sort of Latino films or films made in Mexico, but looking at Hollywood as itself a producer of films about the border.
Do the ones that make the most money, what kind of justice do those types of movies do to informing really what is going on down there?
Gosh, there's a really sort of long arc of history of border films. I mean, border stories take place even before filmmaking. So dime westerns, dime novels, for example, early newsreels. So there's almost such a long history that it's hard to say which ones are the most money-making. The whole genre makes a lot of money for anyone who wants to deal with the topic. But they range from being to the right to being films that question our role in the world, our relationship to Mexico, our relationship to immigration, to migrants. So there's sort of a range of topics that I think...
Well, let me ask it this way, then. Or let me see. This is better. Any film or films that come to mind that did a disservice, that really, you know, did an injustice to our perception of what's going on down there, in your view?
Well, there are a few films from the 80s that I look at. So The Border with Jack Nicholson was meant to be a humane approach to the border, but essentially what it does is it foregrounds a Border Patrol agent, showing them as beleaguered, and that's an idea that continually recurs. At Border Patrol agents is overworked, underpaid, and it uses the migrant to really shore up the humanity of the Border Patrol agent. So it's not overtly negative, but its outcome is negative in the sense that we tend to side with the agent over the migrant, and this is a recurring trope.
Can you talk about that, like how there's you call it a national narrative, and
sure,
what plays out over and over?
Sure. I mean, the border is the place where we really dramatize nationalism. It's the go-to for any kind of nationalist move. So there are a number of shows right now that are sort of premised along the lines of shows like Cops, so procedural dramas that center around agents of the law. So, for example, Border Security. There's a number of shows. I'm not thinking of all of them right now, but they all have Border Patrol in the title, and they're all essentially docudramas or docu-soap operas that take place along the border. And we follow an agent through his or her day along the border as they do the work of stopping people at the border or rounding up migrants. And we identify with them, and we see everything through the eyes of the agent, who, again, is seen as overworked, underpaid, or beleaguered, and caught up in a job that's endless, and for which they themselves don't entirely believe in sometimes, or believe in too much.
How is showing them being beleaguered a disservice?
That they're tired, that the job is unending, that someone in Washington hasn't done their job, and taxpayers are being duped, that tax money is going for this unending process that needs a strong man to come in and take charge.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we get the zero tolerance policy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Say that one more.
Oh, this is where we get the zero tolerance policy, is through being immersed in media that really kind of shows us as this that immigration is a problem that has no remedy.
Mm-hmm. Is that why you're writing this other book on like the security? Is, well, not that they're related, but is that an issue as well, that the security and maintaining that border for these overworked cops? I mean, is that an excuse to amp up the security, or do you feel it's legitimate?
Right, and so what do you do to help the cops? You put in a wall or other kinds of surveillance technologies to help them. And one of the things we're seeing now is the prevalence of drones along the border. And this kind of hierarchy of security technologies that all work together to help these beleaguered agents. And I think the reality TV shows are actually part of the security apparatus. They're what I would say is a kind of surveillance culture, surveillance media. When we watch them, we are engaged in the process and the practice of surveillance. And so that's part of the reason why I shifted into this zone, because I think that these media are actually really affecting people and shifting and changing policy in ways that we may not be entirely consciously aware of.
And then there's the whole, you don't even need a movie, because you have our news media.
Oh, right.
Who's
yeah.
doing a really good job, unfortunately. What about, are there Latino border films that maybe do, that maybe remedy that in some way?
Absolutely. There's a whole range of these films. And then there are films that are big Hollywood blockbusters that are more humane or more left. So so one of the films that I really like thinking about in terms of security is the film by Alex Rivera called Sleep Dealer. And he looks at a number of things, in particular remote work, or this idea of having all the work without the workers. And part of the film, which is a science fiction film set in the future, has a show on it called Drones, and it's actual military drone strikes that are being watched by people as entertainment. And so it's this kind of interface of entertainment and surveillance culture that I think is really timely, even though it's a film that's 10 years old.
Mm-hmm. How, and, you know, you mentioned earlier, Camilla, that a president, any president, you know, puts their stamp sort of on the border. And I was wondering what you thought of how this president is doing that, or what its implication, what you see happening down there as a result of what he's doing down there, even.
Well, this president has taken all of the rhetoric from years past that we've that has been reconstructed and superseded and doubled down on it. So the idea of a wall is almost ridiculous, because the technologies, the ground sensors, the number of things that have been put into place to replace the kind of idea of a wall, he doesn't even seem to know about. And every single president has said that they need a strong border, more border security, more agents. So this is not new, but he's just not informed. He has no idea what's going on, and he's just using the most bombastic rhetoric that's drawn from the worst places to present this idea that he's stronger on the border than anyone else, including someone like Reagan.
Mm-hmm. So you're listening to WPVC, that's 94.7. We're the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We're speaking with Camilla Fojas. We'll be right back with more from her. And also coming up a little later, Ashley Walding from the Virginia Institute of Autism. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We're here with Camilla Fojas. So, Camilla, tell us about a very compelling title, about what this book is all about: zombies, migrants, and queers.
Well, I wrote that right after the great economic crisis, and I was trying to think about the the tropes, the ideas, the people that had been marginalized after the crisis, and so, or the things that kept recurring. So zombie stories seemed to be really prevalent during this time. And I thought about zombie narratives and what are they about, particularly the zombie apocalypse. So what happens during the apocalypse is the end of absolutely everything. Every single institution is gone, particularly capitalism. And so I wanted to see how do we imagine the social formation after the end of the church, the state, the police, religion, and capitalism, and what happens? And it turns out people just simply reconstitute capitalism in some way, or certain kinds of social formations around the same ideas. They reproduce the same things over and over again around race, around gender, and sexuality. Mm-hmm. It doesn't imagine a better future.
And
it's worse.
You think that's in this country specifically, since that's our society's based on capitalism?
I think primarily. I think the zombie story was really prevalent here. It's prevalent in other places too, and it has a history in colonialism. But I think the way that it's been reimagined is particular to this country, particularly after the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
What happens at the end of capitalism?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Are you surprised, or what is your impression of The Walking Dead and its apparent success, since it's been around for a while now?
Well, I was looking at the first few seasons, and it got increasingly sadistic, I think, and it increasingly hard to watch for for me, maybe not for others. But I think that there was this moment where, in the beginning, there was a community formation where people were working around consensus, and then suddenly it became more and more tyrannical. And I think that is the kind of imaginary that the zombie film and media produced, is that we can't really escape capitalism. And in fact, maybe capitalism was better. Maybe institutions, maybe a social structure was better and produced less violence than a social order that doesn't have these institutions. And I'm not saying that that's radical. I'm saying actually the opposite. That's pretty conservative.
And speaking of another book, I know, or another show that was part of your book, also "Orange Is the New Black." So, what issues do you feel they're addressing or not addressing?
Well, part of what I was looking at in the book, and the reason why I looked at "Orange Is the New Black," is I was really fascinated by the prevalence of women in prison narratives, particularly this story. So, after the crisis, you had this idea that, for example, people who failed, who lost everything, could regain it all in a certain way. But who were those people? People like Piper Kerman, who created this book, who found herself in prison but was able to create a major Netflix show and capitalize on all her failures. And so there's this idea that there is a split after the crisis, that people who were in the mainstream actually gained and benefit and capitalize on their failures, whereas people, the marginal, the queer, people of color, got worse, that the violence that they experienced before the crisis actually deepened. And so that was the reason why I was looking at these really white women in prison stories as ways of thinking through what that meant. What does it mean for... There are a number of narratives, of which this is really one of the most exemplary, of women who find themselves in prison and turn it into something. They learn something from it. Write a book. Get a show. Make a new life.
Yeah.
So that idea of capitalism, I'm just thinking about it, that is addressed in, that was sparked some of these shows, that was addressed in some of these shows, and yet it's Hollywood or some part of Hollywood, you know, that's infusing these shows with cash. So is capitalism ever far from anything? You know, is it I'll stop right there.
Yeah, but the end of capitalism now is a storyline. So you have Two Broke Girls, you have a number of shows that are about Undercover Millionaire, Undercover Boss, all these shows that are about people who are masquerading as somebody who might be poor or who's lost everything.
So what about, we talked about capitalism, what about cosmopolitanism? You have a book, Cosmopolitanism in the Americas, and can you talk about how that interacts with social justice, And the concepts that you explore there.
Yeah, so I was interested in that concept. This is really through Latin American literature, which is sort of where I began my academic career. And I was really interested in these writers that had gone to Europe because something, they were looking for something that they couldn't find at home. And usually that something was other cultures that were more liberal, that were more open to gender or sexual difference. And they found that and then brought it home, and it revitalized their own writing styles. And I think there is a potential in cosmopolitanism in this kind of mixing and merging of cultures, as long as those cultures are understood to be equal, that has a liberatory potential. We don't have that necessarily. I think we have a hierarchy of cultures that's a result of imperialism and colonialism in this country. And cosmopolitanism then would be an ideal, kind of utopic aim.
And what is it about racial diversity that is so important to you? Because I know that a lot of, as you said, that's like your background. Where did that start from?
Well, my background is, I'm racially mixed, and I wrote Mixed Race Hollywood with a colleague, or we edited a volume because we were really interested in what's the arc of history around mixed race characters. But my own history is born in Hawaii. My father is Filipino from the Philippines, and my mother is British from England. And so I grew up in three cultures, really, the American culture being the most alien. And also having to navigate between two different sort of empires, two different races constantly. And I was raised mostly in California, where that was sort of okay, but also strange. So I think I've always been a little bit fascinated with that and bringing that experience of migration, immigrants, and all of that to my work.
And what do you see as like the commonalities between Asian, Latino, and Pacific cultures?
Well, I think that in my work, I've looked at the way that these cultures have been impacted by U.S. empire, both in terms of its cultural dissemination, economic, and actual empire. And so that would be one way I think about these places together.
And in terms of like the imperialism that the U.S., that ideology, do we fool ourselves thinking that, is that still so much a part of our policies in general? Is it underlying?
Well, I think we have a mix. I think there's a kind of U.S. chauvinism and a return to nativism, but the impulse is imperious. But the legacy of the United States is that it actually had an empire, and then it has an imperial standing. It's been a superpower for so long, and whether or not that's still the case, it still has a certain kind of force in the world, and unfortunately that's not a good one right now.
In your book, Mixed Race Hollywood, can you talk about just like a particular popular culture medium and what can be learned from that? Like if you just pick out something that you may discuss with your students that is prominent?
In terms of mixed race issues?
Yeah, like how that has either helped or hurt people's views of the culture.
So I think we're living in something, well, we were living in a mixed race moment where every single show on television had to have a multiracial cast or mixed race characters. And that the idea of mixing or multiraciality was, I think, privileged. Now I think that's waning, although I do think it's still there. So what's different now than it was, say, in the 90s and before that is that if an actor or actress was mixed race, they often wouldn't refer to it. Now it is part of people's publicity materials. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to come out as mixed race.
Is there any pop culture or series event that is on your radar to bring into the classroom for the fall?
Huh. Well, the things that
I know it's summer. I know, yeah. I do it. Yikes.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I have I've been watching Black Mirror. I think it's very interesting, very prescient, very very good in terms of its forecasting of things that might happen in a social mediated world. But it's hard to watch sometimes. That would be a show I think has a lot for students to grapple with.
Well, and then in terms of like what that, I know we talked earlier about it, but the book that you're currently writing, it is separate from what's been going on with the White House, right? Were you already starting that long before this all began down at the border?
Yeah, I think there's it's an ongoing story at the border, and I think it just simply intensified is really out of control now. So the story has changed. The policy of not separating families was one that was understood. And if you watch the show Border Security and Border Wars, agents will actually say that we don't separate families in the beginning episodes. I don't think the show is still on the air, but don't quote me on that. Border Wars, it might still be on. But now that's just under so much contestation.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Camila Fojas, Associate Professor in the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. We'll look forward to your upcoming book, Border Securities, Border Futures. Hope you'll come back and talk about that.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you
Nance.
Both.
Yeah. Yeah. Will you stick around or do you need to go?
Sure.
I'm going to take a picture.
I'll stick around, too.
Thank goodness.
I'm sorry. I know you're doing a million things.
I'm going to take a picture of the two, and we'll post it. And then, Nancy, what's your news of note?
Well, my news of note happens to be about the border. And that is the last my voice will sound that nice. The detaining of immigrant children is now apparently a $1 billion industry. It went from like $74.5 million in 2007 to $958 million in 2017, and that was before this latest, like starting in April, this latest government effort to keep every child in a prison camp, and it's up to 12,000 kids. It's not, I know everyone knows, it's not just the 3,000 that haven't been reunited with their families. It's up to, anyway, so from like a few months to 17, they're all imprisoned in about 90 facilities while they wait for their parents' immigration proceedings or their own asylum, which was not, as Camilla was saying, was not illegal. It was not illegal to seek asylum, but now they're using it as a reason to incarcerate everyone. And the shelters are expanding so much that it's obviously up to $1 billion, and they're talking about at least $500 million more. They're going to get bids for that much more for beds, foster care, and secure care, which is employing guards. I mean, it's not going to stop, and this detainment is not conducive to government custody. Is just doing such psychological and emotional damage, mm-hmm. which is the same thing.
As we discussed,
physical damage. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Just as we discussed in detail the last
yep.
show with Jim Cohn. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yep.
You want to?
That's okay. That's fine. What do you got?
Oh, my news of note is a historic peace deal was reached. A little bit of good news between Ethiopia and Eritrea. It ends 20 years of a state of war where 70,000 people were killed and thousands. Speaking of family separation, thousands of families have been separated. So now they can be reunified somewhere in the world, at least. And
yeah.
That is a little bit of good news in the world.
There's a shining hill somewhere other than this place,
yes,
apparently.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So our next guest, we're really looking forward to talking with Ashley Walding. She's the Director of Outpatient Behavioral Services at the Virginia Institute of Autism, which helps children and adults overcome the challenges of autism and participate more meaningfully in daily life and gain more interdependence and independence. Welcome to the show, Ashley.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so could you start out by just walking us through some of the programs and what the mission is of, do you call it VIA?
VIA.
VIA.
Yes, not VIA. A lot of people will say VIA, but it's VIA.
Yeah. Let me walk that back. Okay.
So, yeah, I can talk a little bit about our programs. We're a nonprofit. We have three programs at VIA. I think people are most familiar with our school program, which is K-12. It's a year-round school program because autism doesn't take a break in the summer, so we think it's really important to go year-round. And it is one-to-one staffed, which we also think is really important because that's what the research says works for kids with these types of challenges. And then our students at the day school are referred typically because they have not been successful in their local public school environment. So that's typically how they end up getting referred to us, to the classroom. We have an outpatient program, so I'm the director of that program. We serve individuals between the ages of 2 and 21. We have a really big focus on parent training and outpatient. Early intervention. We have a large cohort of two-year-olds and preschoolers that we work with. And then we also have a school-based team that works with the local public schools to train teachers and staff to keep their students in their least restrictive environment classroom when possible. And our students come, what's different about outpatient is that our clients come anywhere from 2 to 30 hours a week. And it's dependent upon their needs and what they need to work on, and that's really individualized. And then we have an adult day support program. It's our newest program. So it's day support program, and then we're also really working on creating micro-enterprise opportunities for them and vocational opportunities for them.
So, Ashley, at VIA, how does VIA define autism?
So, how do we define it?
I don't know if you got, I don't know if everyone's got a tweak to it.
Yeah. The adage, if you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism.
Right.
I think that is definitely true. But autism, people with autism have challenges in three main areas. So they have challenges with communication, social interaction, and then behavior. And when I say behavior, I can mean the hand flapping and rocking back and forth that a lot of people think of when they think of autism. It can also mean rigidity and routines. That's where you'll see sort of kids who really like to line up objects and things like that. But it can also mean, and what we see a lot, especially in the day school program, are kids who have really severe challenging behavior. So this is severe self-injurious behavior, aggression, and things like that. But it really is a spectrum disorder. And that's what's important to remember about it. It's kind of hard to put autism in a box and say this is what it is, because everybody who has it experiences it differently.
So we're talking with Ashley Walding from the Virginia Institute of Autism. We're going to be right back with more after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Apropos of Something. We're talking with Ashley Walding. She is the Director of Outpatient Behavioral Services at Virginia Institute of Autism. They have a great website. Also, I wanted to direct you to VIA School. You said VIA, right? VIASchool.org. So, Ashley, could you give us maybe a story, just bring us into the picture of some lives that you've actually helped and touched?
Yeah. So, like I said, in our outpatient department, we have a large cohort of 2-year-olds and preschoolers who come, and a lot of them come to us all day long. So we become their preschool program. And for the 2-year-olds, really the research has said that the more hours, the better for early intervention. So one of our 4-year-olds, she came to us about a year ago. And when she came to us, her main challenge was that she would refuse to eat solid foods. She was still eating from a bottle, and her parents were having to blend up all of her food, which you can imagine is really challenging. They weren't able to go out to a restaurant and eat anything with her. They had to bring all of her food everywhere. And so with her, we just worked really hard to slowly unblend the food that she was eating over time, if that's a term. And She ended up a few months ago being able to eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So she did that in our clinic. And then what's most important to us, an outpatient, is that she's able to do that with her parents. Because, you know, who really cares if she can do it with us if she's not demonstrating that skill with her parents? So we brought her parents into the clinic. They live far away, so we're not able to do in-home programs with them. But we brought her parents into the clinic, and we taught them how to do that procedure with a lot of other foods. So she is now eating a variety of solid foods. And that's been one of those, it's a more nuanced story because, you know, people don't think about that as being a challenge, but it was really affecting their lives.
Yeah.
Ashley, I was wondering, you mentioned the families and the parents. I was wondering, how does VIA deal with the parents? I'm sure they, too, are not all the same about dealing with this, right?
No. We have a variety of parent training programs. About a year ago, we started what's called the Strengthening Families Initiative. And what we wanted to do with this was really bring attention to our smaller programs that work with families specifically, because, yeah, each family has a variety of needs that they're dealing with. So one program that we started is actually, it's called Jumpstart. It's for families who are on our outpatient wait list. We unfortunately do have sort of a lengthy wait list for services, and we wanted to create a lifeline for those families, and be able to teach them just a few basic skills so that they had some knowledge of what to do while they were waiting. But a lot of our families are dealing with, like I had said before, really more severe, challenging behavior. So their children might be aggressive or self-injurious or really non-compliant. And so we offer for our families, we offer crisis intervention training for them free of charge. And so what we've tried to do with our families is really individualize what their need is. One of the hallmarks of what we do called behavior analysis is that the skills that we're teaching are socially valid, and that means that they are important for the individual and that they are important for the family. So if the family comes to us and they say, you know, it's not really important that my kid learn math facts, what I really need is for him to stop running out in the street, that's what we'll work on. We'll work on running out in the street. So we do a lot of parent interviews. We do parent-specific assessments. One's called the Parent Stress Index to get a sense of what is really stressful for them, and then try to make our programs fit their needs as best as we can.
So you mentioned behavior analysis, and I know you call it applied behavioral analysis. And I wanted to emphasize that seems like everything you're doing is evidence-based.
It is.
Really proven, and you know what works. And I know you're partnering with the Curry School of Education, who's doing a lot of work with autism. Is there anything you want to say about that? I just found that to be so concrete, the ABA, that you're really teaching, you know, greetings or reading or just life skills, basically.
Right. Yeah. So we are partnering with UVA to do research, because that is what we do is founded in research. You've probably heard, if you Google autism, you get something like 260 million results or something insane. A lot of them are not evidence-based. And so what we do is look at the data of what we're doing. So my favorite way to describe behavior analysis, I feel like I describe it differently every time I'm asked, but is that it is a way of breaking down skills into really small parts, providing a lot of reinforcement for each of those parts, and then we collect data on everything that we do. So what that looks like in practice is, you know, toothbrushing actually has between 16 and 18 individual steps. So we know what they all are, we write them out, and sometimes we have to teach them individually and reinforce completion of each of those steps for our students, and then join them together and take data on how well they're doing on that skill. And if the data are telling us that they're not making progress, we change it. And that's sort of the difference between what we do and programs that are not evidence-based.
I think we forget how complicated executive function is. In other words, you know, what the skills that we do every day, we take for granted, but they're not, they're kind of complex.
Oh, yeah. For our clients who come to us and they might just be working on social skills, there is what's called, quote-unquote, the hidden curriculum. And it's all of those things that we learn naturally just through observing people in our daily lives that people with autism have to be taught. So it's, you know, when waiting to interrupt a conversation until there's a pause. That is something that's a hidden curriculum item that we actually have to teach in a concrete way to our clients. So it's actually a lot of fun to figure out what those things are and to work on them individually.
I had to be careful not to interrupt you during that.
That's okay.
How, and here's an easy one, but I'm sure it's important. So how critical is it early intervention to begin acknowledging there might be something here?
Yes. So early intervention is definitely critical. The research tells us that the more hours a young child can get of applied behavior analysis, the better. That doesn't mean that it doesn't work for older kids, because it definitely does. But, you know, as young children, as their brains are developing and the gaps are not quite as wide, it's really important to get them into that intervention and work on a lot of those very basic skills. So what we work on with our two-year-olds, you know, I encourage people to come and visit us and come observe, because it's probably not what you think. Our kids are not sitting at a table being drilled with facts. It really looks very naturalistic. But what we're working on are skills that we call learn-to-learn skills. So learning to sit in circle time, to follow simple directions, to imitate someone. Imitation is the basis of social interaction. And so we work on all of those things, and we really try to close that gap. But it's much easier to do that the younger the child is.
And what about adults? Is it any different when you're working with adults versus children?
The methods aren't different, but what you're working on does become different. With our adults, we're working on a lot of functional skills, community engagement skills, you know, appropriate ways to act in the community. What's unfortunate right now about adult services is that private insurance actually ends for adults at age 21. And now, if you get services, it's typically because you have what's called a waiver. And those waivers take a very long time to get, and they're not easy to get either. So sometimes what happens is that adults are not in the best behavior analytic program because they just don't really exist. And so that's what we're trying to do, is create a program that allows us to teach skills as best as we can, but at a ratio that, you know, Medicaid says you can work with these adults at a 1-6 ratio or 1-5 ratio, and that's very difficult. So your focus needs to change a little bit to just, you know, community outings and really functioning in the community.
The idea of the community functions and being in social settings, that's also part of what you do for the kids and adolescents too. As you said, you mentioned like being in the school and learning, but you take them out and do things outside of school as well, right?
Yes, definitely. So a big part also of behavior analysis is making sure that skills generalize to the environment that they naturally occur in. So yes, the school program, they do a lot of field trips, but they also work on skills specifically where they'll be taking place. For us, that might look like if a student's learning to purchase things at the grocery store, we're actually going to the grocery store and practicing those things. We also work on things that tend to be hard for people with autism, like haircuts, doctor's visits, the dentist. So we work on those things. In our clinic, we have sort of a specialized room that looks like a doctor's office. And so we practice those things, but then we have partnered with some local dentists and doctors who have allowed us to come in and actually do those things in the natural environment because, you know, like I said before, if it's not happening where it needs to happen, what's the point?
I'd love to hear one more example of a story.
Sure. So this is one of my favorites from when I first started working at VIA. There was a student I worked with who would refuse to go to novel restaurants. So I think the family only had two places that they could go in their repertoire. And they really just wanted to go to a breakfast place and have breakfast as a family. And they would pull in the driveway and he would get very, very upset. You know, a lot of screaming, kicking the back of the seat, really having a difficult time with that. And so we slowly worked him up to going into the restaurant and actually sitting down and having a meal. But it took, you know, okay, today we're just going to go up to the door and stand there for 5 seconds and go home. And then the next day, it's, you know, going in, waiting in the waiting room for 5 seconds and going home. So what we do is not a quick fix. It's not easy or, it can be very slow. But the outcome was that he was able to go to a restaurant with his family. And it's a very simple thing, but it's big.
Fantastic. So I know, do you take volunteers? We'll just maybe close with that.
We do. We can't have our volunteers work directly with our clients, just for liability reasons, but we do really appreciate volunteers coming and help us out with any program development and things like that.
Cool. Hey, Nance, did you want to part with?
I was. Actually, I was wondering any examples of how you engage with the community? Not so much with the students, but with, how VIA engages with the community.
Yes, so we have a lot of events that we're doing. In August, we have an event with Star Hill where they're donating some of the proceeds. If you go to our website, it'll tell you all of the ways that we've partnered with the community and trying to get out there and get our name known. In April is Autism Awareness Month. We have a 5K where we have almost 2,000 members of the community come out and run, which is excellent. We have a gala coming up in October. So we are always trying to get the community more aware of us and get out there.
That's great. I did read about Cheers for Charity at Star Hill Brewery.
Yeah.
Is that true? In August, $1 per pint goes to benefit VIA.
Yes.
All month in August.
Yes, go to Star Hill in August.
Great reason to drink a beer. Thank you so much for being here, Ashley Walden.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Hey, Nancy, how you doing?
Fine. How should I be doing?
Well,
I'm trying
stuff ready.
I'm trying to set it up. I'm not doing a good job. There it is.
It's time for the palate cleanser, everybody. You can go first.
Still want to get into that sound and never leave it. Okay,
it is first. So great.
Okay, it's something controversial, Ellen, but it's far outside of politics.
Okay.
It's controversial in that it has to deal with Crocs. That orthopedic-looking clog thingy, the Crocs, the things purportedly called shoes, but I'm really...
Got it.
I don't know if it's actually footwear myself. However, they insist that they are, and they've just upped the incredulity of their being a footwear product. They're releasing a high heels version of themselves. It features a spray of hideous hardware and chunky, gelatinous 4-inch rubber heel. And they want us to accept this now as an amphibious pump, as fashion. But it's too impractical to wear on a river hike, and it's definitely too ugly, in my opinion, to allow in a restaurant or a boardroom. And apparently they squeak, but they're out there now.
That is crazy.
The croc
high heels.
Anyway.
What do they call them? Croc heels? Or I don't know.
I don't know. But okay. I know. I don't know. Go ahead. Sorry.
So. Archaeologists have discovered 14,000-year-old bread. It's unleavened. It was unleavened, which reminds me of the Passover story. But it was charred remains found in Jordan. And it's the oldest direct evidence of bread found to date, and it predates the advent of agriculture by at least 4,000 years. So this suggests that there's a lot of boring details about it, but I thought that was interesting. They found, imagine what they found. I think there were these charred, tiny little pieces. No idea how they were able to even discern what they found, but 14,000-year-old bread.
Wow. So
I left you nowhere to go with that, except
had croutons on them or
yeah. Do you have some social media news for us?
It's not 14,000 years old, but I do, actually. I do. AOS Radio on Twitter and AOS Radio on Facebook. Please to go there and answer us this. Give us some suggestions. Speaking of crossing the border, Jeff Sessions, who obviously has been out of the news, perhaps, I wonder, if he's on vacation. And that is my question to who's ever listening. If he is on vacation, let's assume he's on vacation. Where is he? What is his ideal vacation spot? It doesn't have to be real. It can be totally imaginary. Where does Jeff Sessions go to chill out should he cross the border and take his, what I presume would be, 1,000 SPF sunscreen with him? But what's his summer vacation spot?
Let us know on
AOS Radio, Twitter, or Facebook, please.
I'd love it to be jail. That's where I'd love to see him.
Well, that would be yours.
I'm going to do a quick station identification, okay? Ready?
Yes.
Central Virginia's progressive voice, WPVC-LP, Charlottesville.
Well, I wanted to thank our guests. We're coming to a close of the show, and thank you, Nancy. So thanks, Camilla Fojas. It was a great interview, and you can catch it on 947wpvc.org. And also, Ashley Wilding, thanks for being here. Our music is by Springtide. Anything else you want to? Oh, I wanted to say that. Remember that no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. I was a little light on the news, so Nance, thanks. I'm glad you brought us up to speed.
You're welcome.
Anything
right.
else? All right. Thanks, everybody.
Yes, that too.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team and Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.